If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and a reality check you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio. The Fourth Estate is RCR's newest discussion panel. Today on The Fourth Estate, your host is Marie Buskey, with panelists Professor of Economics at Auckland University, Rob McCulloch, and digital marketing expert and women's rights campaigner, Annie O'Brien. It's time for The Fourth Estate.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Reality Check Radio, to our second edition of The Fourth Estate, our new Media Watch show that looks at media analysis and features a range of qualified guests and commentators. And I have got two incredible commentators this morning joining me. First up is Annie O'Brien. Good morning, Annie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Very good. And of course, you have got a digital and marketing background. You've been around the political sphere for a long time, and you're quite the warrior on X, I have to say.
Oh, goodness. I'm always a bit apprehensive of whether people see that as a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, it's always good to be able to sort of, let's put it this way, it's nice to see that it doesn't always flow one way. So I do certainly appreciate your pithy commentary. And of course, I've got Rob McCulloch also with me. And you said to me earlier, you don't want academics to sound dull, but I've listened to some of your pieces that you've done with Paul. I've read a couple of articles. You certainly do not make economics dull, my friend. You make it rather interesting and relevant to the real world. So hopefully we can put that great mind and wit to media this morning. So good morning, Rob. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning.
Right. We've got a lot to have a look at. And of course, you know, there's still the fallout from the announcements that have been made in recent weeks around News Hub and in the continuing. It's almost like a memorial before the funeral has happened that has been going on. And I'll start with you, Annie. There have been calls now for Melissa Lee to step in. Some have been very critical that they felt that she hasn't fronted this more readily and that there needs to potentially be intervention. Really?
It's a real tough one because my natural inclination is to say, time to get the government out of it. And the last government spent far too much time and money getting very involved with our media sector. However, if the whole thing collapses, we've got nothing. So it's a tricky one. And I think Melissa's got a bit of a job in terms of needing to balance, I guess, keeping our public media platforms afloat. But also not continuing this, you know, absolute grift really that happened under the last two Labor governments. You know, the Public Interest Journalism Fund and all its stipulations, and also more importantly, the really inflated advertising that they paid for throughout COVID and arguably didn't use as much. We don't want any more of that. But yeah, I think there will be a thorough examination done by Melissa. And I don't envy the job of trying to find balance there.
Mm. What are your thoughts on it, Rob? I mean, your observations. Do you think that the government should be stepping in to maintain this so-called balance that we have, or should she be looking at something entirely separately?
Well, I agree with that, Annie, that of course, there's a public good in journalism that's fair and balanced and the public feel they can trust. But, you know, that's very important and it's important for democracy. But a media which starts to become heavily slanted, biased, becomes captured and used by the government, as it seems we saw a lot of these past 5 years, That is the worst case scenario. In fact, a media that can be used by, you know, a government with an agenda, that's sent many nations down terrible paths in history. So, you know, it's certainly not a solution to pour money into media outlets where the folks get hold of that money and just think, sucked in. We've got all this money and now we'll go down a political agenda and we'll attack our enemies, people who we think don't think the right way, have a different sort of political belief system from ourselves, and we'll try to swing elections and we'll try to interfere in democracy and push our own agendas. We certainly can't have a repeat of that. So, you know, we need a strong, robust media, but we need one that fairly reports, you know, the truth and that the public have trust in. And I think there's been a betrayal of trust the last 5 years. Many people have gone off our mainstream media because they don't think it's been doing its job in that way.
So do you think if by saying for Minister Lee to step in and actually do something in terms of restoring some balance, that they have to be careful what they wish for, because in her investigation, she may actually restore that balance, not where they think it will be restored? So I'm talking alternative media, looking at places and spaces who are attempting to do things like what we're doing here at Reality Check Radio. You've got Chris Lynch doing great work in Christchurch. You've, platform Love or Hate, the personalities there, but they are offering a voice and an alternative view in another space. So, you know, there are actually other people out in the spaces at the moment, and, you know, restoring News Hub isn't necessarily the solution. So if they called for, we need you to step in to provide balance, she may choose to provide that balance elsewhere, maybe.
But
you go again, Rob.
You go.
It's a very good point. I mean, this government has shown on a few different fronts, on many fronts, that they are wanting to do things a little different. They recognize that there was a lot of unhappiness from, you know, the COVID times and from the last government, and they are seeking to kind of turn things around. And I would say that in the media space, they would not want to risk being accused of the same manipulation or use of the media, but they would potentially want to change the mix of where money was going and how it was being deployed. So rather than having ideological stipulations for receiving funding, perhaps that there would be some kind of principles around fairness and balance that already exist in charters and in expectations, I guess, in most of these companies, but aren't being enforced or aren't being properly adhered to. So perhaps bringing in some kind of, you have to really demonstrate that you are living to these principles and operating editorial stances that have balance and that challenge both sides of the political spectrum before you can expect to get funding. Now, some people would say there should be no strings attached, but perhaps just expecting those tried and true journalistic standards to be upheld should be a stipulation. And as you say, perhaps it's providing funding for new players in the market. As far as News Hub goes, I think the best thing that could happen is for private capital to be invested and for, someone else to pop up and say, hey, actually, there's, a whole lot of assets that are going to be really hard for a News Hub to sell in terms of broadcasting equipment and that kind of thing. There's an opportunity here to buy out the entire business and put it to good use. But again, be careful what you wish for. The people who want to see their jobs saved at News Hub, someone buying them out might not like it if the editorial stance is a bit different, the new owner. So there are kind of a few different ways that could play out.
What are your thoughts, Rob?
Yeah, my view is we need a new model, that the old system is obviously broken and it was corrupted these last 5 years. And I think you make a very deep point, Murray, that you can't have a situation where the big outlets start asking for a bailout and the new players, and you know, that's what revitalizes and refreshes nations. You have new entrants and new types of people coming in, and you can't bias things against those kinds of people in favor of the big established players. My view is this country needs a refresh in a lot of ways. It's sort of the old systems seem very broken. The US has, America even has a public broadcasting service, the PBS, and I believe it's the most trusted outlet in that country. It receives grants, public grants, but also has to seek private donations. And so that sort of keeps it on its toes and keeps it honest. And everyone who gives money, public or private, have to sign up, like Annie was saying, that they commit that there is no strings attached to the gifts, that they're not going to try to influence the content in any particular way. They're not going to sort of capture the outlets. So a new model seems to be, you know, required. But this old model where just more money is poured into the players who failed and who have been proven to be pushing an agenda these last 5 years, you know, and against new starting outfits, I think is wrong.
Well, it's that whole adage, isn't it? You know, the definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing, yeah, expecting a different outcome. Yeah. And I think that's what we have here right now. In a way, you've segued beautifully into the next section, which is to fund TVNZ through a series of levies. That idea has been floated. Now, you're possibly not old enough, Annie, but I certainly am, and I think Rob might be as well, to remember that I'm feeling a little deja vu around potentially funding our media using a levy. Rob, I don't know about you. Remember the old broadcasting TV license fee? Sounding rather like that to me.
And the BBC in Britain famously has had the licensing fee, which is enormously controversial. Look, my view on TVNZ is that it should go and be a whole new entity, should be established. And probably there is a case that it receives public grants, but whether it's a non-for-profit. My view is that TVNZ betrayed the public trust these last 5 years. I don't think there's any question about that. There are public news services around the world that the public rank as the most trusted in their nation. And I think many New Zealanders felt that TVNZ, when they looked at what they were offering, it no longer became a trusted news service. I know leading up to the election, about a week before there was a leaders' debate, One News ran a fact-checking, and some of them were my colleagues at the university. I don't know them personally, but they fact-checked Luxon and Hipkins. They said that Luxon told 4 falsehoods and Hipkins none in the debate, and one of them was on economics, and it wasn't a falsehood at all. It was, you know, they'd got their economics wrong. So I think when you have One News calling the now Prime Minister, you know, what are they saying, a falsehood? They're saying he's a liar, a compulsive liar, saying 4 lies in a leaders' debate. And the other guy's saying none, even though he said that we're the second fastest growing economy in the world, which is just nonsense. And, you know, you can't have a state broadcast that's been captured in this way, that's relentlessly pushing a view, thinking it's funny to try to swing an election. My view is they've lost their social license to operate.
Mm. And they're patronizing their consumer, aren't they?
Yeah.
They've made a decision, a moral decision, on what they believe the consumers are able or capable to consume, and then put out product in regards to that without actually, I think, engaging or listening to those consumers who have been quite vocal about how they feel about the product, and that seems to be ignored. Yeah. Which then sort of beggars the question, you know, that prior to with the 2020 election, one of the things that got canned, and dear Willie Jackson, I know, was deeply upset about this when he was then broadcasting minister, was this suggested merger between Radio New Zealand and TVNZ. Now, personally, I think that that was a disaster waiting to happen, and I was actually kind of pleased that they pulled that off the table. I mean, could you imagine that sort of monolith being created in the media space? Those are my thoughts. What about you, Annie? What did you think? I mean, because I think they may suggest this re-merger again as a way to provide media with government support.
I really hope they don't, because I was quite happy to see that fall over. In New Zealand, often in big sectors, we are faced with duopolies and even just small pools of players. And it's a challenge because on the one hand, we're just too small to have massive diversity in any sector, really. But it is really important in critical places like media that we do preserve, that kind of separation and diversity that gives people options. In saying that, the diversity doesn't really exist. They are running the same product. But in theory, there should be different, people making different editorial stances, providing different products, which then give people choice of what they engage with, and then whatever private players are in the market as well. What has essentially happened is, apart from all of the technological changes that have really affected the sector, they've also essentially committed suicide by picking a tiny sliver of the market and all trying to fit in there. So, of course, there's not enough of the pie to go around, but they've neglected the rest of the pie where people want, different kind of editorial stances, different kind of products. And they're all fighting for this tiny sliver that they all believe is the only true way and the Leishman ideology and all that. And they've just fallen over because there is just not enough advertising money, not enough subscriptions, those kind of revenue channels to justify them all being in that sliver of the market. Now, if some of them were to have a look, for example, either, the space that's being filled by alternative media like yourself, but also you look at News Talk ZB, they're often, accused of, well, they're the right wing media platform, but they kill the ratings on mainstream media radio every time. So there are a lot of centre middle New Zealand listening to them. Now, if one of these players decided to enter the market and challenge them, there's more pie to be shared there. And it's really simple market analysis that just doesn't seem to be done. And on the merger, if they were to merge, it just takes away another choice, and it makes a bit of a beast that is, I guess, with the way things are right now, always going to be pushing that agenda that's only for that sliver of the market.
It's interesting what you say about the market, Annie, because, I'm a business owner and I do advertise using mainstream media, and I've actually worked selling radio advertising as well as working in broadcasting. So I know the backside of it quite well and the economics that run it. And it's really intriguing because as things have ideologically shifted seismically to the left, and they have created a product, because the entire thing is, you're right, you create a product, create a product that brings in listeners, that brings in numbers. And because of those numbers, you then can take that product out to the marketplace and have them sell advertising. Now, when I was selling advertising, it was easy. It was on stations that the whole focus was on the community, what's going on in the community, the key headlines with the news, music that everyone wants to listen to and tap their toes to when they're at work. Life was simpler then, but it was the 90s. What can I say? Now we have exactly what you've said, the sliver of the market that is very tiny. And they also have an ideological place where they only like to spend with their very favorite people. They're very select about what they do. And then sometimes those people don't like to pay for it at all. We've seen that this last week or so. Anywho, moving on. Then they also don't like to and they don't like to spend. They actually find that showing their fiscal privilege. So from an advertising standpoint, they're not attractive for advertisers. And if you're spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions in the case of really big spenders back in the day, you need bang for buck. They're not getting bang for buck on any form of legacy media and traditional media. They're getting that bang for buck online. So, you know, I guess economically, Rob, doesn't it? It all comes down to the numbers.
Yes. My view is the country really needs to change this sort of gradual, incrementalism. We need a massive refresh. My view is that many Kiwis we've had a gutsful of so many industries being dominated by big players. And that's a major part of the cost of living crisis. So we have essentially only one airport in the country, one international airport. Christchurch does it, few in Wellington, but Auckland Airport's the gateway. So Auckland Airport, like a monopoly, Air New Zealand, a monopoly on really domestic travel. You have the big supermarket chains with huge market power, Fletcher's. Now, then the government says, well, let's merge Radio New Zealand and TVNZ. Wherever we look, we just see these behemoths Fletcher's got 70 million in wage subsidy. These players are just dominating sectors of our economy. And I think there's a certain anger about that. And certainly when it comes to a public broadcaster, if there isn't absolute trust and faith in it, if it's going to try to be just leading a political agenda, then there's no point to it. The whole point of a public broadcaster is it's giving, balanced views. But if you go down an ideological route, what is the point of having it? Mm. So, we certainly need this range of views out there. And as Annie says, I absolutely concur. When you look at the broadcasts, they've all been trying to outdo each other in even more extreme insults and views on, ACT and NZ First, and who can outdo each other more. And I think everyone's bored with it. I mean, News Hub last year, I made a complaint on them. They started down this road. They're interviewing an economist I know a bit, Shamabeel Equab, who said the Nationals' pre-election budget was bullshit. Well, you said don't use four-letter words. Well, they put that word front page on News Hub, that the Nats are talking bullshit. So says an economist. And then the same guy said David Seymour was financially illiterate, and the ACT, economics was full of lies. I mean, they're all trying to outdo each other. It's a badge of honor. Can we, insult, someone from the so-called right parties more? And I think that they've lost the plot in that. So the industry needs a reset.
Well, it's often too not just clickbait, but it's egos involved. And speaking of egos involved, what do you think about the Film Commission chipping in $800,000 for the new documentary film about Dear Leader, as I like to call her, Jacinda Ardern? I mean, again, talk about not reading the room.
We've had a few instances around funding and film and arts and culture recently where kind of the country's gone, what? Wow, why are you doing this? In this case, we've got, I think, with Jacinda's new doco, there are two main objections. One is that people are sick to death of hearing about what a savior she was during COVID and don't really want to talk about COVID anymore anyway. The other thing is, The way they justify getting $800,000 of the taxpayers' money was that they had done analysis and it was going to be commercially successful. If something is going to be commercially successful, why are we funding it? Why are we not funding grassroots, projects where the injection of funding is going to enable, good old Kiwis to get ahead and make some great content. If this is an internationally potentially successful commercial venture, they should be paying for it themselves. These are there are some players involved who do have the ability to raise funds. I think they've raised about $2 million themselves as well. And I just think we have to be a little bit more discerning with how we allocate funding for these kind of sectors. It's important to fund the arts, but we shouldn't be funding the arts that's already established and that can create their own capital. Like, we should be funding the grassroots.
Yeah, I totally agree. What are your thoughts with this, Rob?
Yeah, well, like Annie says, I mean, the biggest media enterprise industry in the world, Hollywood, called Hollywood, doesn't receive a dollar in grants from the US government. I think that film is wildly inappropriate. I noticed that they're touting the film. It was in the Herald, and the official blurb on it is it's about the Dern, and they say the rise of violent extremism in this country. I tried to work out where they got that from. That's the motivation for this project. I'm not aware of a rise of violent extremism in this country. When you look it up, I mean, that's not referring to crime. There's certainly a rise in violent crime, but extremism, violent extremism conjures up terrorism. If you look it up, this country is not a country that has had an experience of rising acts of terrorism. I can only find two official terrorist acts, which were Christchurch and the Rainbow Warrior bombing. So there's not a trend increase where we're getting, and Christchurch was done, what, by an Aussie citizen who came over and did that. There's not a sort of terrorist movement in this country where we have rising acts of terrorism from sort of an outfit like the IRA in Northern Ireland, with more and more bombings every year. So the whole pretext of it seems odd. It just seems sort of advertising for the left and advertising for a Dern. So I can't really see the point. It's obviously highly politicized. And there are many more, I think, worthy Kiwis of maybe doing a documentary on. Right. A galaxy of famous Kiwis who've contributed to this nation. Why not do it on them? I mean, AI is in the news every day. One of the founders of AI, Shane Legge, runs DeepMind, Google's worldwide effort in AI. He's from Rotorua, for God's sakes. You know, I mean, we have a Kiwi who is one of the world's founder, world's most influential people who's driving the global AI effort. Why not do a documentary on him? Why does it have to be a politicized thing on taking it to further enhance her sort of global stature?
Yeah, it definitely does smack of trying to keep her star alive after it did sort of dim so rapidly as people started waking up out of that sort of fear and coercion model of COVID. And you're right. I mean, I live in Hawke's Bay, so of course we've got Rocket Lab just up the road, and what they've done in such a short space of time, and they have literally bought the space race to New Zealand. I mean, it's an incredible story. You're right. Tell these stories. And of course, today is March 15th. So it is the anniversary of that attack. And if there is any, from my perspective, it's the handling of that by Jacinda, just from an empathetic point of view, outwardly was very, very good. And she did, she did actually provide a lot of comfort for those people there. But then what was wrapped around it, the politics that then suddenly got wrapped around that, with in terms of the gun buyback and then with the COVID measures that then followed, and this, all those powers that got pushed through under urgency when those COVID measures got pushed through with no discussion whatsoever. And it was interesting, we can't do this because of terrorism. Now we've got this because of COVID. The clear and transparent government that they promised to be was certainly very non-existent. Yeah, I think it'll be intriguing to see what uptake the film gets, if it gets made, if it gets completed, what the numbers are, and actually stand those numbers up against the River of Freedom and see, that film was packing out houses the length and breadth of the country and was this incredibly poignant documentary made by a collection of largely citizen shot with professional shot optic. Beautifully, beautifully done. I'd love to see how many people engage with this documentary. I fear it may not be many.
I assume that the River of Freedom didn't receive a cent of funding.
Oh, I think it was all publicly funded. Yeah, feeling it. Donations. Yeah, amazing. Yeah. I mean, we see what that can happen here, and we're thankful every day to every single one of our donors here at RCR, because without them, we couldn't do this.
Well, it's highly charged, because if you notice, Ardern gave commencement address at Harvard and is now at the Kennedy Center as we speak at Harvard University. Part of why she's got those positions is over gun control. The Americans, she's touting herself as that I can do gun control, and she knows it's an issue in the United States. So she's there saying, look, you know, invite me everywhere because I'm the person who can push through gun control. And you guys can't even do it there. And even the documentary, which is publicly funded, will it be a fair and balanced account? Will it just be a kind of that she did everything right? I mean, even the fact that she wore the veil, which was her famous photograph. Well, you know, if you're going to report both sides, the veil is a symbol of oppression.
I had real issue with it.
Iranian women are dying for the right not to wear the veil. So there are, you know, if you're going to report that in a fair and balanced way, was her symbolic photo of wearing the veil sort of tacit, you know, what was it? Many people think it wasn't for in favor of freedom and liberation of women. So.
Yeah, it would depend on what they do. But I suspect that this will be a 90-minute propaganda piece that will be aimed at expanding her work opportunities overseas.
Yeah. And it definitely, I doubt very much whether it will cover, you know, I was working at Parliament at the time of the opposition, the battle that we had where she was shutting down Parliament. She did not want Parliament to sit. And even what we ended up with in the end, with the like kind of partial, smaller representation with Zoom and stuff, was so heavily controlled and slanted by the government. It was impossible to argue these things because the media just sided with her and said, yeah, of course we should shut down Parliament. Well, no, we shouldn't. It should be, you know, it's the type of thing when it comes to democracy, the opposition is vital at times like this. It was so hard to be the opposition, and I doubt whether there'll be anything shining any light on that and how hard it was to oppose, you know, any of the policies that she just basically unilaterally announced.
Mm. Rob, you wrote a really interesting blog piece around the media and democracy and how they're reacting and acting to the news of what's going on, particularly Jack Tame. And again, like what Annie was saying, there's lots of difficulty when you've got the prevailing government of the day closing things down. It sounds like there's the same sort of disbelief from journalists like Tame. Talk us through some of your thoughts on that, because I thought that was quite interesting and it was a slightly different observation and take than what you're currently seeing in other outlets.
Well, my view is that many of the big outlets just don't really respect the election result and regard this government as somehow illegitimate. A majority of Kiwis voted for this government. You know, they've got over half the vote, and that seems lost on TVNZ and stuff and News Hub, that actually the majority of Kiwis, I think, want this government to succeed. For our country to succeed, this government need to succeed, because the country's not in a good state. And it seems to me most of the big media journalists want this coalition to fail. Well, by the way, if this coalition fails, this country fails. That's very clear. We've had a terrible last 5 years. And if the next 5 or 6 years, the economy's mired in stagnation, recession, should we fail the next 5 years? We have record outflows of Kiwis going to Australia and leaving the country. You know, so it's bizarre to have a mainstream media wanting to bring down this government. And I think even now they're showing that that's what they want. Even today, as we speak, I notice you go into One News, Jack Tame's written now an opinion piece saying that it's awful that the government are cutting taxes on landlords at this time. It's sort of a terrible thing that they're doing, and not giving police a bigger pay rise. Now, what he's done is symbolic of a corruption of the media. He doesn't call it an opinion; he calls it analysis. So the big thing now is that all of One News and all the reporters say, "I'm doing analysis." It's actually quite deceptive. That it's saying that you're like me; you're a kind of nerdy person doing an objective analysis. No, his article is that, in his opinion, that it's outrageous that landlords get a tax cut and the money should have gone to paying the police. Now, you can have that priority. You can have that opinion that Tame has. Other people have another opinion. You know, other people think there's maybe a shortage of rental property and we need to encourage more, you know, supply of rental property. That's a valid view to have. So to me, you know, if you're going to report in a balanced way, you know, you shouldn't just say, in my opinion, it's despicable that the government is sort of favoring landlords and trying to beat up on police. That's just his opinion about the situation, which he calls an analysis. So I think this is an example of how, you know, our big media are taking the country down a bad path. They don't regard the government. They don't regard Luxon as a legitimate leader. They're trying to paint him as a fat cat who owns his rental properties, they're just attacking him relentlessly. Most governments have a honeymoon period when they're elected. Even, you know, in countries where, you know, you might not greatly like the president, but the first 6 months is called the honeymoon period, where people, you know, get behind the government the majority have voted for. This government's had no honeymoon period at all. It's just a relentless kind of negativity. And by the way, if this government fails, the country will fail. So maybe these folks like Jack should get that very clear. I try not to be partisan in my comments. And I've equally critiqued the Nats and harshly critiqued ACT. But I know one thing: should this government fail the next 6 years, our country will fail.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the points you brought up there was around the use of analysis over opinion. Now, to me, that's another classic example of manipulation, particularly with those on the ideological left. You surely would have experienced and seen this manipulation of language, Annie, in your experience when you were working in Parliament. They have become deft masters of the dark art of language manipulation.
You see Jacinda Ardern's press secretary for most of her time, all of her time, Andrew Campbell. He's a master of spin. I think Hipkins is struggling without him because they've had an absolute master of spin working in there. And kudos to him for doing his job well. But I definitely think that in terms of the media itself, you know, we would find things where Judith would do something really quite normal and the whole world would end according to the media. And then Jacinda was getting passes left, right and centre. You know, one time we were down in Queenstown and I don't know what the level was in terms of restrictions. We had to be wearing masks, but we could, you know, go to restaurants and stuff. We went to get an ice cream after a dinner that we'd been at, and Judith took her mask off to eat the ice cream, and some person filmed us. And it was front page news the next day that she had taken her mask off. And I just despaired at that point. I was just like, I spoke to some of the journalists and I said, what is the value in this? Like, what is the public interest in this? She didn't actually do anything wrong. Like, you were dealing with people who are so ideologically wedded, and they think, instead of thinking their job is to report what has happened, they think it is their job to convince the public of the right way. And that means that some of the rules go out the window, because when you're on a crusade for what is right, you know, sometimes there, you know, the means justify, the ends justifies the means. And so, yeah, we've definitely got a situation where there's manipulation. I mean, I've written a piece for ZB. I'm not sure if it's been published yet or not. But I basically analysed how the media has treated the tobacco situation with Assistant Health Minister Casey Costello, who I will disclose as a friend. But I've kind of just looked into how they've framed things and then compared it to the situation where Chris Hipkins actually worked for Todd Energy, which is our local oil company in New Zealand. And how, if I wanted to employ the same dirty tactics that the media used to frame Casey and New Zealand First in really unfavourable light, I could create a conspiracy around Chris Hipkins working for Big Oil. Now, I don't think there is a conspiracy, but I could create one using those techniques. I could say, look, he had a meeting here and a meeting here, and not disclose that there were opposition MPs at that meeting as well, or, you know, those kind of things, those tricks where people don't realize they're getting half of the story. They're not getting the full context. They're being told, look at this dodgy thing over here, but they're not being, there's a lying by omission. And I think that is really fraught throughout our media.
Yeah, it's in all of these things accumulative. And I think the public have seen that. So that brings me to a piece that Marty Sharp wrote earlier in the week, the 11th, in Stuff. And Marty is a senior journalist for Stuff. He's actually based in the Bay here, so I do know him. Not well, but I do know of him would probably be a better description. I did have a little chuckle. It's a very comprehensive piece on media trust, and he's done a lot of work, and he's spoken to a number of people around that. It was a great piece. If you know what I know, I did actually, the irony, believe me, there was eye rolling. Anywho, he does cover the research that had been done around trust in the media that is quoted, so 42%. That survey is about to be released again for this year, I think, in the coming weeks. So it'll be very, very interesting to see what that will be. They do predict it will drop again. One of the quotes in there, and it goes to something that you just said earlier as well, Rob, was from, and of course now she had it, and then she goes, there it is, co-author of the AUT report, Dr. Mirja Mulilati, says that it's impossible to pinpoint the drop in trust to one single factor. It's hard to say if it's connected to the political and government trust, but it comes through in all the reports that people are fed up with having the news mixed with opinion pieces. This is very clear. People want factual news and opinion separated. And they've sort of meshed, and it's what you were talking before with Tame, like opinion and personal views of journalists have now been meshed into this journalistic framework and all called journalism, when in reality it's not. It is opinion, it's your point of view. Now, I've had people say to me, oh, you know, you're on RCA, you say this in an interview, you're a journalist. No, I'm not. I'm an announcer. There is a very, very distinct difference between the two. I'm an announcer. I'm not a journalist. So I'm all about what I think, what comes to my head, and I drive a conversation in one direction or another. That's all I do. So there is a very, very distinct difference. And journalism has become lost for all intents and purposes for so many. And it's really difficult when you actually find good journalism. It's kind of like, oh, what is this mythical beast? We haven't seen it. And it's really sad, I think, to see the trust disappear like this. And COVID is, I think, did a lot more damage than they've anticipated. And it will be interesting to see whether there is a linkage between that media loss and trust and the COVID inquiry, and whether that gets picked up as part of the wider fabric of the inquiry. So what are some of your thoughts around what COVID and the political machinations that happened there that were really sped up the lack of trust for most people? like your example with the ice cream would be a clear one, Annie.
My view is if the certainly government funded media don't have trust, they don't have anything. There's just no point to them. You might as well have Fox News, have whatever you like. And people are just, like you say, relentlessly giving their opinions. The only point of, you know, the government helping the industry and, you know, funding a broadcaster is that it enhances trust. And I think there is proof that that trust has been lost in this country. And I think blaming over, you know, technological change and blaming the web, and I think it's a Tame was doing that. I'm just going to blame everything apart from myself and my colleagues and, you know, my wife, who also works at TVNZ. We're not to blame at all. It's all because of the web. Well, actually, no, there are a lot of highly successful media outlets throughout the world. The media economics is a huge field, and how to monetize and make money out of, you know, media outlets. In fact, the NZ Herald, it's one of the most visited websites in the country. I think they get 1 to 2 million hits a week, for God's sakes. It's just after Google and Facebook. There is no shortage of people hunger for news. It's hard to monetize, to make money out of selling news now. But many companies around the world have, you know, cleverly dealt with that. One of the biggest media companies in Norway, it's called Schibsted. And the reason they started having a decline in revenues was the same reason the Herald and many of our outlets, they lost the classifieds. That was the main reason they started losing money. Trade Me did the classifieds, and that was the main loss of revenue. It came from that. Now, Schibsted in Norway saw that it was losing classifieds and started its own classifieds, you know, because so many people visited the website. If the Herald had been properly run, which it hasn't been for many decades, it would have got into the classifieds as well. And it would be one of the richest companies in this country, but it lost several billion in market value to Trade Me and the other outlets. I think Schibsted has now just bought eBay. It runs the largest classifieds in the world, a Norwegian company. Well, Norway's like New Zealand. It's a similar country. So cleverly run companies have got into this. There's this thirst for the news. People will visit you if you're writing good stuff. And then you can try to, you know, you can make money out of bringing all those people together and connecting them and, you know, creating a marketplace for classifieds. There are business models for that, which have not been done well in this country at all.
Part of it too is actually even reporting the news and reporting the things that people want. As you said, having the classifieds, that's something people want. One of the things of the stories this week that's broken, which I'm struggling to find any reference to anywhere, is this massive story about the WPATH files. And you've got the NHS now stopping the prescription of puberty blockers to children. Huge story, huge, huge story. And here in New Zealand legacy media, crickets. Now, Paul spoke this morning to Jan Rivers for Public Good, and it was a wonderful interview this morning. So if you haven't caught that live, do go back to the replays and check that out. I didn't realise that in New Zealand, as Jan was saying, we prescribe from a pro rata perspective 10 times more than what they do in the UK.
This is a drum that I bang a lot, so I'm sure some people
bang away, Annie. Get that drumming, bang, bang, bang. Because I think there is. I'm a parent, you know, and I just look at this as a parent, and it breaks my heart. And so many, when I've had parents come to me since I started the show in this last year, I've covered this topic too, and they go, "This is going on in my school," and I'm like, "Yeah, yeah."
As people in the UK are saying, some very high profile people and people involved in medicine, this could possibly be the biggest medical scandal of our lifetime, because there are going to be hundreds of thousands of young people whose bodies will be irreparably damaged because they were put long term on drugs that are actually supposed to treat prostate cancer.
They stop the production of hormones. So obviously for prostate cancer, it helps because it stops testosterone being made. Then that reduces the ability for cancer cells to continue to grow. But you think about when you put that kind of medication into a developing body, prepubescent or even an adolescent, what you're doing is depriving the body of sex hormones. So whether it's testosterone or estrogen and whether you're, it's a female or a male patient, what you're doing is affecting a whole lot of growth, because in adolescence, that's where we do our developing. And a lot of that is brain development. And so things like emotional regulation, cognitive function, it's all affected by our sex hormones. And to think that nothing was going to be, a long-term impact from using these drugs is absolutely absurd. And so, I'm not surprised that this is not being reported on, because our media has chosen again and again to ignore the topic. But it is very disturbing, because it is a case where a drug that is used for children overseas has been deemed too dangerous for them. We are continuing to prescribe it here, and our media is not reporting on it. I've immediately written to the Minister of Health, and I hope that there is some kind of, assessment done, looking at the NHS as kind of a model that we have, looked to in the past for guidance. I've been battling Ministry of Health on this for years. They claimed that these drugs were reversible for years. It's only been very recently they removed that claim from their website. They're supposed to be doing some kind of review into them, but they announced the review, I think, in June last year. And then in December, we were told it was coming, and there's still no sign of it. The problem is that, like much of our public service, the Ministry of Health is just riddled with people who really believe in all of the gender identity ideology. And so they have vested interest in protecting the use of this drug. Which is just highly unethical. But it's the level of capture that has gone on. I can't say enough how much we need to stop these drugs being prescribed to children in New Zealand. And I don't think I will ever forgive our media for choosing to ignore the topic and to facilitate basically the continuation of people being ignorant to what's happening.
One of the proponents, of course, of this in the media has been Chenille Lal, in terms of looking to protect it. And his work around the conversion therapy bill. So then, of course, that opens up a can of worms, because they have a similar thing in the UK. So I've spoken to transsexuals who went through the old system, whereby you had a series of counselling, you lived as the opposite sex that you were wanting to transition to, you did all of these things. It was a long, drawn-out process. Now, that conversion bill, if you had somebody, a child, who is feeling confused and you're wanting to counsel them from a psychological perspective, if you've got a particular parent or ally that goes against it, they could then invoke that bill, could they not, to prevent you or stop you from counselling that child for what are very normal emotions. Is that correct? Have I got that right?
Basically, they have asserted that gender affirmation only is the pathway that doctors have to take. They cannot do a watchful waiting scenario where which is proven in research to be the most effective way of dealing with it. And I'll just say, as a lesbian myself, I oppose the conversion therapy bill because it has created a new modern type of conversion therapy, which is that because the affirmation model was the only one to be used, you have a whole pile of young people who would otherwise grow up to be gay or lesbian, who are instead being pumped full of drugs and cross-sex hormones, ruining their bodies and sometimes their lives, because they're gender non-conforming when otherwise they would have grown into healthy gay adults. So I see that as conversion therapy. And it really puts doctors, psychologists, parents in really tricky situations where they want to make decisions in the best interests of that child, but they've been told that the only acceptable way is this funnel of puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, surgery, and to employ any other course of treatment is conversion therapy. We don't do that for any other illness or disorder or situation. You know, most of the time the discretion is left to the doctor to say, well, actually, in this case, I think this course of treatment is most effective. Doctors are being hamstrung by these laws and policies. And I mean, in terms of Chenille Lal, who the hell is he to be listened to on any of this? He's a seriously troubled young person. And I think is given far too much influence. He's been on all these government panels and whatnot. He's just a young person who made a lot of noise. And I despair that his opinion on these matters, as ill-informed as it is treated like it's of any value to these conversations.
Well, it's one of the things in terms of those conversations is that often you will hear opinion from one person, i.e. Chenille, but then you do not hear opinion from somebody on the opposing side of the fence. For argument, say yourself as a lesbian woman. Yeah. It is very one way. And within the rainbow community, so of course our papers have been full this last week, right? With pride parades being back on the agenda and lots of pride out there. Now, I've got a lot of gay friends, a lot of male gay friends. Some of them were at the forefront of homosexual legalization. So I'm old, so they are of an age. Now, they're appalled at all of this. In fact, they completely disconnect. They see the rainbow and they run the other way. They're disgusted by it.
Terrible. And what's happened is, I don't think we've got a similar kind of piece of research here, but in America, they do regular surveys on attitudes towards gays and lesbians. And you can chart the increasing tolerance and acceptance all through 90s, 2000s, getting, homosexual law reform and all sorts. The minute all of this gender identity stuff comes in, it starts tanking and we're at record lows now. And it's affecting lesbians and gays where this has nothing to do with us. Especially like you say, the older cohort and a lot of lesbians as well of my age, we just sit to death of it. And so we disconnect from pride. I didn't go to pride this year. The rainbow flag looks like a threat rather than a symbol of support. And I'm just sick of, KTMs and buses with rainbows on them. I'm like, just give it a rest. So it's actually the media has so much to be kind of held responsible for in this space because they have picked and chosen the stories that they've run, like we've said on other issues. They have pushed gender affirmation only models. They've pushed sob stories about trans people without talking about the sob stories of the detransitioners who've ruined their bodies because they were 14 and they listened to the doctors who told them that this was the right course of action. So it's a classic case. If you wanted to choose a topic to look at media manipulation and slanted editorial stances, this would be a perfect case to do that.
Mm. Well, have you got any thoughts on this space, Robert? Have you come across anything particularly around the university place, where I know that the queer agenda is one that is very, very entrenched, and this is one-way traffic in terms of how things go in regards to gender. Have you seen anything that puts your hackles up and concerns you?
I'm not an expert on the topic, but I relate very much to what you both have been saying, in that in my space, more in economics, my subject, the big media are relentlessly choosing sort of one particular person maybe they like, and endlessly reporting their views, and then just not picking up on the range of opinions out there whatsoever. And I talked to a former finance minister actually about this, because I've been writing for years and done articles, and I used to do articles. I no longer do now for the mainstream media, because I'm fed up with them. They started manipulating my articles, changing words in them to change the meaning. And so I just stopped sending them articles. But I said to a former finance minister, what's going on? He said, oh, well, in your case, what their strategy is, they would have talked about you because you sort of considered somewhat a troublemaker. Their strategy with you is ignore you. You know, just that's their strategy, just ignore you. And so they have a group of us they just ignore. They never pick up on you. And they only report, you know, one particular favored, chosen person. And this seems a systematic pattern when it comes to talking about the pandemic or virus issues. Let's put 1,000 articles and interviews with Michael Baker, with, you know, Sean Hendy, Lucy Wiles. Let's do 1,000 interviews with them. There's maybe someone out there with a different view. And there were eminent doctors out there with alternative views, but let's just not interview them at all. Let's just pretend they don't exist. When it comes to any economics issue, on capital gains taxes or wealth taxes or any of these issues, or the national's budget, let's just put the one guy who says it's bullshit and, you know, establish the narrative and fact that it's all bullshit and that Seymour's a lie. And let's just not give a whole range of economists with a different view on that issue. And I think, and on this issue, what you're describing, they'll have a chosen person who seems to get endless coverage. Mm. And that the range of views is not expressed. And I think that is behind a collapse of public trust in many of the journalists working at these big outlets. And a whole new arrangement needs to be worked out.
Yeah, actually, in the Marty Sharp article, one of the things that they indicated in there was that people were seeing things on the mainstream media. They knew it wasn't sitting right with them, so they went off and did their own research, found these other voices, and that led to the erosion of their trust. Shocker.
Yeah.
You know, again, that's the patronising of your consumer base, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, I was very sceptical of the media anyway, and very critical of them. But when the protests at Parliament happened, I wasn't involved, but I was living in Wellington, and I was seeing the reporting on the news, and it didn't sit quite right. So I just decided, right, I'm going to go down there. So I did spend today wandering around, talking to people, asking them why they're there, and just checking the place out. And the reality that I was seeing, hearing, and on the ground bore no resemblance to what was being reported in the media. And that was that for me. I just, like, I felt like it was blatant lies. And I'd really felt for the people who, you know, had shown up to protest. It was their right. All they were asking for was for one bloody politician to show up and listen to them. And even their motives were being lied about, their who they were, the links to Nazism and whatnot that were just not there. it was a real stark example for me, coming from the outside of that community that I wasn't part of, but wanting to check it out for myself, and just, yeah, discovering the lie.
Mm. Judge Harvey said here a few weeks ago, he was saying that in his day, misinformation was called lying. Misinformation was rumors, disinformation was lying. And I like to add that malinformation is the inconvenient truth. And, you know, we have loads of that everywhere, and it's just been rumors and lies. And I went to the November protest, and I remember posting a couple of images from that day. I took up protesting in my 50s. I'm very new to this. And it's a new hobby. You know, they say to you as you get older, take up new hobbies. It's good for you. So I took up protesting, and it was a very new thing for me. And I'd never done anything like that before. And I loaded up a van of girlfriends, and all of them were affected by mandates in one form or another. All of us were. And so down we went to that day. And that was another thing, the reporting. Oh, a few thousand people, they said. A few thousand. It was far more than a few thousand. It was, I mean, to the point that it choked everything in Civic Square. You couldn't move or swing a cat anywhere near Lambton Quay that entire time. You got up to Parliament grounds. It was spilling out down around outside. Mm. There were that many people there. And it was actually a really joyous day. We drove down. It was a long day. We'd left at 5 a.m. from Hawke's Bay, drove all the way to Wellington, did the protest, had a spot of lunch, drove all the way home. It was a huge day. And I had a couple of people on Facebook. It was actually that day that led to quite a big purge for me on social media. And someone said, you were down there with Trump supporters and QAnon. And I was like, I don't even know what QAnon is. I was down there with nurses and doctors and teachers and midwives and parents of those people who were really worried at what they were seeing in their country. It's insane. Well, any final thoughts of things that you would dearly love to see in the media this coming week that may not be reported or could be reported a different way? Just breaking this morning, of course, I mentioned just before we got started, was another Green MP has got themselves in a sticky wicket. It will be interesting to see on how that gets reported. News Hub, actually, to be fair, had something that was very, very factual. Maybe they potentially learnt their lesson. I don't know. What are your thoughts on what you may or may not see this week, guys, this coming week?
Well, obviously, I would like to see some pickup on the NHS ban on PQB blockers and the various other strands of that. As for the Green Party, they're having a bad run of it. They really are. It'll be interesting to see how this one plays out. I guess one thing that I think needs better coverage is the example that yesterday David Seymour had a haka done to him at a school. And haka's part of our cultural identity. We do it before our rugby matches and other sports matches, and that's all good. And I know that it's used as a symbolic challenge and whatnot. But I do think there needs to be a bit more critical reporting on the fact that young kids were spitting at a prime minister and the haka was performed with less symbolic challenge and more aggression. And so I think that this idea of just like good on them, which seems to be the attitude of the media, is dangerous, because the more you embolden people to be physically aggressive to politicians, the more it's going to happen. I mean, we were all getting upset about mean words being saying about Jacinda, and that was the end of the world. Well, you know, this is a bit of a step further when they're being spat at. So I think I would like to see a bit of sensible reporting on that, and a bit of variation on the narratives that it's not just a absolutely fantastic thing that it happened.
What about you, Rob? What should be talked about in this coming week that you think is going to be a bit light?
Well, on Seymour, I also thought the idea that young kids are practically spitting on a guy who's going to be deputy prime minister. I mean, why? Why would they do that? I suspect that complicit in that is many journalists who've been reporting on him. in an extremely unfavorable light, and maybe the education system, how they've been educated, maybe that's playing a role. And, you know, the journalists are sort of sitting back having, it seems, created tremendous division and then kind of reporting on it in an innocent way. I'm noticing very lately, Maria, a bit like you, that I think that's why shows like this are very important, that it's gaining traction, that many of the journalists and big media have been so biased in the past. And I'm looking for it now, a slight shift, as they're desperate for some public money. They're desperate for bailouts. They're trying to sort of don't like this backlash that there's such low trust in them. And shows like this, that they sort of think, oh gosh, maybe we should just report a bit more fairly on the story than we have been, which, you know, would be a good thing. They, you know, they've got to change, clean up their act.
Well, I think to quote Jack Tame, was it in your blog piece, it is a little bit like trying to bail out the Titanic with an ice cream container, I think, aren't they? If they're trying to, you know, sort their act out now, I think, you know, potentially that ship very much has sailed. Hey, look, this has been absolutely brilliant this afternoon. I really do appreciate your time. This is the Fourth Estate here on Reality Check Radio. Thank you so much to Rob McCulloch, economist, academic, and man who knows many things, for your opinions this morning, and for also the wonderful Annie O'Brien. Thank you so much. And listen out again to our first episode of this wonderful show, which will appear in our replays on our Reality Check Radio app. So thank you very much, team. Thanks, Annie. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you. That was really good.
You've been listening to The Fourth Estate on RCR, Reality Check Radio.